Welcome to In the Weeds with Nicole Asquith, exploring the way culture shapes our relationship to the natural world.
If I sing the song you just sang to me back, but I sing it as we say in music, sotto voce, half voice, there is nothing that says more than that.
Really?
So
more than if you sing it louder.
Yeah, so it's like,
how interesting.
That's Alan Clark, Associate Professor of Biology at Fordham University, speaking about the politics of birdsong. I interviewed him last summer at the Louis Calder Center, a 113-acre wooded estate with a 10-acre lake that's belonged to Fordham since 1967, a biologist campus where they research things like the thermal defenses of the eastern small-footed bat against white-nose syndrome and urban evolution in lichen. It made me fantasize about that parallel universe in which I'm a biologist. To get there, I took a hairpin turn off a forested road in Westchester County. It feels a little Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe when you drive through the gates. The place is remarkably quiet and feels remote despite the fact that it's only 30-odd miles from New York City. Clark's office is perched at the top of Calder Hall, the old stone building that serves as their research center. Seems appropriate that somebody who works on birds has an office that feels like a nest up in a tree. We started out by talking about his background and the unusual path which led to his work as a biologist. Alan Clark learned to love nature during his childhood in rural Wisconsin.
I was able to spend a lot of time in the outdoors, unsupervised, and just grew to love wandering through the woods and the fields, and I became passionate about bees, butterflies, and birds. I love them.
After college, where he studied music, education, and religion, he planned to go into the Peace Corps, but
there I am, 3 weeks before I was to leave for Africa, my program was canceled.
Ronald Reagan had just cut the program. He decided to take a position teaching music at a school in the Ozark Mountains that, as he put it, hadn't been able to lure a music teacher for years. He took his students into the city to expose them to culture, going to museums and concerts. On one such outing, he saw that auditions were being held for a musical, decided to audition, was cast, and launched into a new career that eventually led to 5 years in New York, where he performed in professional opera, musical theater, and comedies. Eventually, he decided this wasn't really the life for him. He still felt the call of his early interest in wildlife and decided to work in wildlife conservation. There was only one problem.
And so I contacted graduate schools, and they were like, you don't have any science or math.
So rather than going to graduate school in biology, Alan Clark got a joint law and master's degree in natural resource policy from the University of Michigan, which allowed him to get a job with the Environmental Defense Fund in Washington, D.C., and then with the EPA developing Clean Air Act regulations. But once again, he felt this wasn't really the work he wanted to do. He managed to get a research fellowship that allowed him to go into the field, to compare laws and policies on endangered species and biodiversity with what biologists were finding out on the ground.
Just because, remember, I'm still always in my heart, I want to be a field biologist.
Right, right.
And I got, they funded me.
You found a door. You found
so I've never been out of the country except fishing in Canada. So there I found myself in New Zealand interviewing biologists studying endangered species. And I was on the South Island, and a gentleman who was studying yellow-eyed penguins after my interview said, well, do you want to see him? And I go, the penguins? And he said, yeah. I go, okay. I had never seen a penguin, not even in a zoo. So he took me out, and there they were. And I was smitten, or in English, I was gobsmacked.
Oh, yes.
And I turned to him, and I said, David, who now is a colleague, I said, if this law thing doesn't work out, I want to be a penguin biologist.
But this isn't the end of the story. His next job was at a law firm in Seattle where he worked on land conservation.
I discovered that I wasn't happy there, even though it couldn't have gotten better. I worked on great projects with good people and made a decent living. I mean, how much better do you get than that? Most lawyers I knew were miserable, and I was, but for different reasons.
And here's my favorite part.
And my secretary, she'd gone to Williams and gotten an English degree, and she wanted to become a veterinarian. Of course, she was in the same boat as me, no science or math. And one of my clients went to one of those woo-woo schools where you don't get grades. And she was working for a small nonprofit land conservation organization, and she wanted to go higher in land conservation and felt like she needed a graduate degree. So the three of us went to community college together for 2.5 years.
Wow.
And I took pre-calc and calc and intro bio and chemistry and organic chemistry. And my secretary is now a practicing veterinarian.
Wow.
And my colleague, she is now the CEO of the largest land conservation in the West Coast.
What an incredible story.
And I got to follow my dream, and I study penguins now.
Isn't that a lovely story? From music education to penguins, Alan Clark also bridges that nature-culture divide that interests us. In two earlier episodes, The Violin Maker and The Violist, we looked at the ways in which music connects us to the natural world, and is arguably, at least when it comes to wooden instruments, a gift of the trees. Through his study on birds, Alan Clark also connects human culture, including language, but also our art and our cities, to the natural world.
Because of my music background,
yes.
When I started studying penguins, my advisor, she said to me, okay, we've got penguins, what do you want to know about them? And I'm like, well, I have a music degree. Has anyone studied their vocalization? She goes, well, not really. And that's how long it took me to figure out my dissertation topic. You know, and then I parlayed that into other areas, studying vocalizations of local birds here in New York and Connecticut, and how birds migrating through New York City and other large metropolitan areas, how they use their vocalizations to navigate bright and noisy environments. And then I continue to study the penguins, too.
Hmm.
And more recently, I have been doing a lot of work studying bats using their vocalizations.
So my impression is that with bird vocalization, that there's a lot of new science. There are a lot of new developments. Would you say that that's accurate?
Technology can take us so far.
Hmm.
And, you know, to study bird song was very difficult, even 40 years ago. If you wanted to record bird song, you had to have a lab, and you would have a rotating drum that you had a needle on it that you would burn something under it to smoke, you know. Mm. And that was some of the earliest ways to look at bird song. But even
explain, why would you burn something?
Because that's what creates the blue, you know, the palette for the needle to scratch on.
Oh right, okay.
But even in the 60s and 70s. People would go out in the field with gigantic reel-to-reel recorders, you know, with the tapes each being about 6-8 inches across with two of them, and you would have to carry them and find an energy source. I did my PhD work with cassette tapes, and so using analog rather than digital recordings is a very different world.
Mm-hmm.
And then also software programs to analyze calls.
Right.
When I did my dissertation, I would make a picture, what we call a spectrograph or a sonogram. Mm-hmm. And it would, you know, on one axis you have, you know, how high or low the pitch is on the up and down axis. Mm-hmm. And on the other axis, the horizontal axis, it was time.
Mm-hmm.
And that is how you would look at what we hear. So you can see voice prints or... and then you can actually measure what is, you know, how many of this kinds of element are there, and what height are they, how long do they last, you know, or do they modulate, are there overtones, and so all those things that we measure by hand. I studied the role of ecstatic display calls with Magellanic penguins. That's the male's advertising call that I'm hot and I'm, you need me. I measured 27 separate parameters for each call, and I calculated that I made over 60,000 measurements.
Wow.
And nowadays, you can have a program do most all that for you.
Right. And of course, you're analyzing sounds that are heard by different ears than ours, right? So there needs to be some kind of translation. A clear example would be your work on bats, right? I've heard that if we were able to hear the sounds that bats make, that they would be deafening. Is that accurate?
They would certainly be loud.
Yeah, they would be loud, right?
They're exceedingly loud. Absolutely. The same is true at both ends of the spectrum. So for like marine mammals, the kind of noises that we make in our environment through seismic testing and defense operations literally deafens marine mammals.
Mm.
It is so loud. And the same is true outside our hearing range, in the shorter frequencies, the shorter waves. So it would be, I think, quite loud if we had. And so it's important when analyzing calls is what are the physiological structures that the creatures have and to perceive them.
To perceive them, right. And how do you analyze that, or how do you know about that? Yeah.
I mean, a lot of times people used to do measurements of in ear structures. You would take a dead animal and measure the various components, which would tell you what frequency range they could hear, or they would test it to see vibrating. And so they were fairly primitive measures, but they have a good sense of what can be heard. And fortunately for humans, birds tend to sing exclusively in our hearing range.
Yes.
So it's not like, you know, if you're a bird or a butterfly or a flower and you've got UV light colors, UV colors.
Right.
We miss that beauty. We also miss ultrasonic and subsonic sounds as well.
Mm-hmm. So I understand that the scientists speculate now that there may be a common origin between human language and birdsong, or some relationship there. Could you explain that to me?
The physiological structures that coordinate hearing physiologically in birds and humans is very similar. Sort of like in much of science, they will use laboratory animals as models. Mm-hmm. So from fruit flies to fish, to rabbits, whatever, because we all have an evolutionary history. And so a lot of the pathways that evolution has taken are very similar. And the more similar it are, the more relevant it will be to humans. And bird song is a model for human learning. Most birds learn their songs. Not all.
I understood that from reading your articles. One of the things I wanted to understand is how do we know that? I assume we know that by watching their behavior, by the fact that we... So the adults teach their young, essentially, how the ones who
really
do learn?
It's really complicated, and I teach animal behavior to undergraduates. And, you know, every species is a little different, but there's usually a time period where a young bird needs to be exposed to the song it needs to produce in the same species. Mm-hmm. It needs to hear it.
Right.
So whether it's, you know, so we can call that maybe a tutor. And then there's a lag period, and then they have a period where they practice, and they actually will learn, you know, context, neighbor's song, and so forth. And so there's a plastic phase. But then it's
Do they make similar errors, or do they stumble the way that human children do?
Their first songs look terrible.
Really?
They sound terrible. But they practice very hard for a long period of time.
It's rather touching.
Because for birds that learn their songs, they tend to be used also for mate choice. Mm. And so how a male sings is very, very important to a female. And so if he doesn't sing a good sounding song, or if his repertoire isn't large enough, then that probably means he's not a very good choice for a mate.
What's the speculation as to why that's the case?
And there's lots and lots of reasons why you would want a male that sings a good song, because it could mean that they know the local song, so they're locally adapted physiologically. You're a local bird. You don't want somebody who evolved somewhere else, because they may not be very well ready for your offspring to survive winter.
Interesting.
And also, if they have a good, solid, strong song, that means that they probably had a good chickhood or childhood.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And when development, because if you are undernourished during when you were young, it can lead to issues as an adult.
Mm-hmm.
And so you may not be as strong or as smart.
And so
birds that have large repertoires or can sing perfect, beautiful songs, it suggests that they will be better genetic material for your offspring.
That's fascinating.
And so birds can tell a lot about another bird just by their song.
by the quality of their song. So I know that you study bird signatures, right? I'm sorry, vocal signatures in sub-ocene birds. So that is that? Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Sub-ocene.
So those are birds who don't learn language, and I presume that we see that because they start making the vocalizations.
Even without being exposed to it. Right. So without any exposure or training, they can produce a reasonable quality sound for that species.
But we think that birds in that category can also recognize individuals.
Yes, and so we know from the ossine literature, so ossines are songbirds that learn their songs, because songbirds or passerines or passeriniformes are divided into ossines versus sub-ossines. And the distinction is, do they learn their songs or are they hardwired?
Okay.
And so in the New World, we have birds like our flycatchers. So our phoebes, our peewees, and our flycatchers, they all are sub-ossines. Mm-hmm. And they comprise about 40% of birds. Mm. About 60% of passerines learn their song.
And did you choose to study sub-ossines because it was an understudied area, or was there another reason?
When I began studying penguin vocalizations, one of the first things you do as a graduate student is you dive into the literature to see what's already known about a topic or
right.
a species or a subject. And almost all of the penguin vocalization literature was based on ossines, studies of ossine birds. And at the time, there weren't very many studies of penguins. And what was known about bird song was known from studies of ossines.
So are penguins all sub-ossines, or do they?
They're not a passerine.
Of course, yeah.
Right, and so they're also called perching birds, and of course a penguin isn't going to perch.
Right.
But
do they learn their vocalizations?
Their
they don't. Okay.
Right now, you know, and there's all subtleties of all of this, and there are wonderful exceptions. So there are. Some sub-ossines that are born knowing their songs, and those exceptions are marvelous and wonderful, parrots, hummingbirds, and cowbirds.
Interesting.
Yes. So if you're a cowbird and you're a parasite, so you a cowbird female lays her eggs in another bird's nest. Now, if you're a cowbird, you don't want to learn the song of your host. You want to know the song of a cowbird, but you don't have a cowbird.
Oh, good point.
So
yeah.
You may have a chipping sparrow, mom and dad. And so if you grow up attracted to chipping sparrows, you're an evolutionary dead end.
You're in trouble.
Right, because you will not have successful offspring if you choose to mate with a chipping sparrow. Mm. So they already know their songs. They're born knowing cowbird songs. Mm. But I became interested in sub-ossines because there was so very little done with them. And one of the big questions is, we know that ossine birds can recognize each other by their vocalizations through lots and lots of different studies. And I showed that penguins can recognize each other by their songs. I showed that statistically their vocalizations between individuals are individually distinctive. And then through experiments, I showed they actually can recognize individuals.
So do birds have something similar to grammar or syntax in terms of, I'm sure it depends on the type of bird that you're talking about, but in terms of sequencing and meaning, can
absolutely.
We talk?
And one of my favorite birds is the song sparrow. And when I was learning how to study vocalizations and record, one of my advisors was chair of the psychology department at the University of Washington, and his study system was song sparrows. And so a song sparrow will have 6 to 8 different songs that solidify. Mm-hmm. So it tries out a bunch, and then once it gets someplace and settles down, it listens to its neighbors and it makes its final choice about what will be my song. Mm. And those songs, once they're learned, are used in context-specific ways. So every morning I get up and I go around the edge of my terrio and I announce to the world that I am alive and this is my territory, stay off.
Okay.
And that's part of the dawn chorus, and they may do that periodically all day long, go around their territory and announcing that, yes, I am here, this is mine. Now, there are always conflicts because those borders get established through conflict. So if I'm singing a song and my neighbor has a choice, they can respond to me by singing the same song if they know it, They can sing something that's in my repertoire that's a different song, or they can sing a song that I don't know. And all of those have different meanings. And so through playback experiments in my advisor's lab, they showed what if I sing a song, an adult of our repertoire, and then I sing the same song back, that's basically declaring war. And so you can de-escalate it by, you know, so there are rules in how they use them. And so that's one way that birds use song, is it's context dependent, based on the repertoire. And that's why you need to kind of know your neighborhood songs when you're growing up, because you may need to use them in order to de-escalate conflict or to start conflict. Because if you're big and buff and your neighbor's kind of wimpy, why not take over some of that territory? So you challenge them and you will likely win.
Right. I'm seeing parallels with musical theater here.
But there's one other very, very common way, is they will have a different song for a different purpose. And it turns out to be more complicated, but a lot of our beautiful warblers that have the beautiful songs that we love so much, they will have a song that's used primarily for territory defense, and another one to attract a mate. And so, and then, of course, there are species who use both in differing contexts for both. But that's sort of been a classic divide, is your territory defense songs versus your love calls, for your mating calls.
Yeah, I can see why you wouldn't want to mix those up.
Though, it's interesting, they can be used in different contexts, and also, and how loudly you sing it. When I was mentioning the conflict between the two neighboring song sparrows, if I sing the song you just sang to me back, but I sing it, as we say in music, sotto voce, half voice, there is nothing that says more than that.
Really?
So,
and more than if you sing it louder.
Yeah, so it's like,
how interesting.
I will sing it back like this! Even if I do it sotto voce, it's very soft, and that is sort of what happens right before a fight.
It's provocative.
Yes. Huh? So when you whisper it back to me.
How interesting.
I know your song. And so, and I'm anthropomorphizing because it's more fun that way, but.
Well, I feel like I wrote a little piece about anthropomorphizing that was inspired by my daughter, but I feel like, you know, that's one of the cardinal sins, but that it's also a necessary tool, right? Because we're always trying to translate in some way.
And it also gets awkward. And if you can explain that, yes, I will anthropomorphize, but humans are animals. And and we use animals as models for, so many things in science, including our health. And so it's not a big step to think of ourselves as animals, and that animals may have emotions. And it also, it's more engaging if you don't have to qualify all the time.
Right.
And so it can make for a more engaging, discussion or lecture, or a way to connect students to the material by, giving it an anthropomorphic context, as long as you're honest about what that means.
Right. And as you say, we are animals, and in some ways the bigger problem is that we see other animals as being distinct of another order, so we need to find ways to kind of reintegrate our understanding of ourselves in the context of other animals, right?
And one of the largest growing fields in the field of animal behavior right now is animal personality.
Interesting.
And so study after study are showing that, you are not a generic house wren. You are not a generic bobcat. You have a personality that's different. Some are shyer, some are more aggressive. And so there are, they have personalities. And anyone who's ever had an animal will tell you
knows that.
Right. But we, in science, we tend to sort of do the other.
So I wanted to talk to you also about your work in cities. You have a number of projects where you're dealing with the impact of human behaviors, human structures on wildlife that traverses the city. And one example of that is your work on green roofs and the impact that they have on bats. Can you talk a little bit about how you came upon that project?
Well, when I first came to Fordham, I didn't really want to be in a city. I'm a backwoods boy. Grew up in the country.
Where did you grow up, by the way?
In Wisconsin.
Okay.
And I love remote, quiet, natural landscapes. But this is where my job was. And so I thought, well, I'm here. I want to really focus, have a part of my research be about urban landscapes. Hmm. Fordham University is in the heart of the Bronx, mm-hmm. in one of the largest megalopolises in the world. And what an opportunity to understand, because our world is increasingly urbanized. Mm-hmm. Now more than 60% of the world lives in cities. And that number is expected to climb dramatically in the next 50 years. So most people's experience will be of an urban environment almost mm-hmm. exclusively. But that also means is urban landscapes are growing mm-hmm. rapidly, mm-hmm. taking up more and more of the mm-hmm. available space on Earth. Mm-hmm. So how does that affect wildlife? Well, the number one cause of species loss is habitat loss, whether it's for agriculture or cities or whatever the human induced change in the landscapes. So I became really interested about how we can make cities more accessible for people to understand and experience mm-hmm. wildlife, and to provide see if we can improve urban landscapes for wildlife. Mm-hmm. So that was sort of the context. I was mm-hmm. really looking mm-hmm. for, not just the eastern wood peewees, suburban birds, but also in the city itself. Mm-hmm. And so I had a master's student who had joined the program at Fordham. He came into my office and he said, I want to understand how birds use green roofs. And I said, okay, I'm open to the idea, but what's a green roof? And so he explained to me, and so he became one of many students now at Fordham who was focused on green roofs. And we've had a lot of mm-hmm. students, and I've had students study the invertebrates on green roofs, bats on green roofs, mm-hmm. plants on green roofs, and of course birds on green roofs, mm-hmm. And how small green spaces can really actually provide habitat. And that's mm-hmm. what most of our studies are showing, is that green roofs can be a really, really important component of the mosaic of green spaces in urban landscapes that can actually provide habitat for wildlife, as well as provide a benefit for humans in lots and lots of ways. So I won't go on and on about green roofs, but they actually extend roof life, which most people are like, really?
Interesting.
And they can reduce heating and cooling costs by over 30%. They can also dramatically reduce stormwater runoff, which in a city like New York, which doesn't have a separate mm-hmm. system for rain runoff and stormwater mm-hmm. and its sewage, it all gets into one. It's called mm-hmm. combined sewer, and they overflow. Combined sewer overflows, and the plants that treat sewage can't handle it, so it just goes, raw sewage goes into our rivers anytime mm-hmm. there's more than a quarter inch of rain in New York City.
That's a sobering thought.
It is. And so, green spaces, including green roofs, can really have a dramatic reduction if they can temporarily hold mm-hmm. that water.
In terms of wildlife, I imagine it depends also on what kinds of plants, right? Because bats need insects. Insects are more likely to exist where they have plants that they can eat, right?
That's absolutely the right connection. And we had a PhD student, Jace Aloisio, who is now working at the Wildlife Conservation Society, and he looked at varying kinds of communities with native plants and different kinds of plant communities that are local to this area that might survive on top of roof buildings in cities, because they're hotter, mm-hmm. they're drier, mm-hmm. and so you kind of have to be a special kind of plant to live on a green roof,
I would imagine.
And so he experimented and found some. He also followed natural succession. If you just put soil up, what happens? Mm. What plants? And do we care if mm-hmm. they're native or not? Mm-hmm. And so that was and then also, what is the, what kind of the benefits are versus a lot of greeners are sedum. Just small, mm-hmm. short, mm-hmm. 1-inch succulent. They've got big spongy leaves. And they need almost no maintenance, almost mm-hmm. no water. They're easy to grow, and most green roofs are sedum. Mm-hmm. Even sedum roofs, though, can have a tremendous effect on wildlife, mm-hmm. in addition to the other benefits. So, but the deeper the soil, if you can have shrubs and plants that are taller than sedum, mm-hmm. you dramatically increase the amount of food available mm-hmm. for invertebrates. Because mm-hmm. invertebrate plants are the foundation. Invertebrates eat the plants, and everything else eat the invertebrates. Mm-hmm. And so if you don't have invertebrates, you won't have much of anything else.
Right. This is a bit of a detour. Well, perhaps not. But do you feel that things like green roofs is one of the things that we should be doing to address climate change as well?
It can have a really cooling effect. So most city roofs are dark. Mm-hmm. They absorb heat. Mm-hmm. So if you just painted your roof white, you would reflect the light back up and reduce heat, because cities are 8 to 12 degrees warmer than nearby rural areas. It's called the urban heat island effect. And green roofs can help dramatically reduce the urban heat island effect. Also, you've got a carbon sink there. And so is it going to have a major impact? No, but the amount of space available for green roofs in a place like New York City is astonishing. And Europe is way ahead of us on that, on legislating and requiring and encouraging green roofs. We're working right now with I'm part of the New York City's Green Roof Researchers Alliance, which is hosted by New York City Audubon. And we've just had our first conference last year. We're having another one. We're working with City Council on a number of bills that would encourage or require green roofs or solar panels or other means to take advantage of our buildings and to benefit wildlife, infrastructure, stormwater runoff, and the urban heat island effect.
All these puzzle pieces fitting together, right?
Right.
Yeah. Interesting.
And so, I mean, there's a cost for these things, and so trying to figure out an economical approach that makes sense so that it can happen, because there's so much benefit, but most of the benefits of green roof are public benefit. So, you know, cleaner air, cooler temperatures, but there are some private benefits, lowered cooling costs, longer roof life, and so, you know, trying to find that balance of encouraging a private project that has a tremendous, primarily public benefit is always tricky.
No, I think about that too. I serve on the village board where I live, and so I'm often thinking about, you know, when do you legislate, when do you encourage, and how do you encourage, you know, how do you draw that line? Because we all need to be thinking about the future. It's more pressing than ever in some respects. But you also need to get communities to buy into what you're trying to do.
Well, and I wanted to mention one thing that you had asked about. One of my students, Dustin Partridge, the PhD student I was telling you about, who asked me about green roofs. Mm-hmm. So his latest study with another former graduate student of mine, Caitlin Parkins, who's also at New York City Audubon, she looked at how bats use green roofs compared to comparable nearby green roofs, and showed that there's much more bat activity over green roofs. Of course, you would suspect it's because there's probably more invertebrates. And of course, Dustin has done work to show that, yes, there are dramatically more invertebrates on a green roof than a traditional or conventional roof, which, of course, you would expect that, but there's actually been very little study demonstrating that and the magnitude of that difference. So what they combined their talents, and Caitlin recorded bat activity, and Dustin recorded moth activity and other arthropods and vertebrates. But our most common bat in New York City, which we discovered, which everyone told us it was definitely the big brown bat, and before white nose, it might have been the little brown bat. But we discovered it's actually the eastern red bat, and the eastern red bat is a moth specialist. And so their data is beautiful, two lines going up and down. The more moths there are, the more eastern red bat activity are. You know, demonstrating what we would think, but they were able to show.
And that's because of the particular type of moths that were available, you think? You think it's because of the food source?
It's a correlation. That's how you start with, you know, science in general.
Right.
And so they're natural experiments. You're just recording what's there and looking at relationships.
Yeah.
But when there are no moths, there are no bats.
Yes.
When there are lots of moths, there are lots of bats.
I'm under the impression that my mosquito problem is significantly less now that I have more bats where I live. Do you think that that's likely to be the case?
There are definitely bats that specialize in mosquitoes. There is a wonderful study. There was a doctor who was very concerned about malaria, and he had seen bats eating mosquitoes. So he actually shifted away from malaria research to trying to figure out how to get more bats places. And so he started doing small things, and nothing was working, and he built this gigantic bat house, and the bats wouldn't move in. But he finally got it. And where he put up his bat houses, malaria essentially disappeared in those areas.
Really?
And I can send you a link to
this story. Yes, I'd like to see it. Yeah.
And it's a magnificent story about how understanding the local wildlife, mm-hmm. and it's important to human health mm-hmm. and to a good functioning ecosystem.
I think that's a question that I've been asking myself a lot, is how do we convey to people the importance of local wildlife? And the problem is that it's not always a one-to-one correlation, right? You know, part of what I want to be able to convey to people is why biodiversity is important to us as humans. Not that that's the only reason that we should support it, but I think that, you know, the average citizen who is not a scientist or doesn't have a particular interest in wildlife doesn't really speculate that much about it. Still, we are still very much, I think, in a mindset of human world, natural world, as if these two were sort of distinct. In spite of the fact that the science has shown us that
couldn't... That separation is growing dramatically.
Yeah.
I grew up wandering aimlessly in forests and fields.
Yeah.
My family was a hunting family, so, you know, they've spent a lot of time out in the woods, but developing appreciation for it. You know, that's just part of my world. It's part of who I am. But humans evolved with nature. And there's all these wonderful studies that show if a classroom looks out on something green, that alone will improve student performance. Mm. All they have to do is see green, and they will do better. Mm. Everything else being the same.
It's kind of heartbreaking.
And so, there's a number of years ago, a book came out about labeled nature deficit disorder mm-hmm. and how mm-hmm. important it is to, you know, expose our children to nature. And they don't get that very often. I can remember I was working on a project trying to get New York City high school students connected to nature more through urban ecological research. And on our pilot program, I was at the Prospect Park Zoo. I put up mist nets. We caught birds. They got to touch them. And we started, and it changed their worlds. And even though they were in Brooklyn, most of them had never actually been to the beach. Even though they're in a coastal
city.
They're
not far.
and none of them had ever been on a hike. And so the opportunities really hadn't been available for them to connect mm-hmm. to nature. Mm-hmm. Because if you want people to care about nature, how do you get that to happen? And it's usually because they've experienced it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why I think it's really important that our cities provide mechanisms and opportunities for people mm-hmm. to connect more deeply with nature.
To have those experiences.
So pocket parks and green roofs. Mm-hmm. And just so many different ways that mm-hmm. we can make our urban landscapes better for both wildlife and people.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. There's another project of yours that I read about that had to do with an art installation in Philadelphia. I'm curious about that one. Could you describe that for me?
Well, one of the things that when I got here and I'm like, okay, I have a background in music and penguin vocalizations, and I started asking people around, what do you think are important questions for urban landscapes? And someone at New York City Audubon said, you should talk to this guy, Andrew Farnsworth, who uses vocalizations that birds make when they migrate to understand them better, because most birds migrate at night, mm-hmm. which a lot of people don't know. When they do, they produce these very short, almost unhearable, what we call contact calls, night flight calls or nocturnal flight calls. And what Andrew has done, he has sort of done a Rosetta Stone of the warblers and other species, but figuring out what species were what as they passed over. So he was using, acoustic recordings to try to better understand how birds move through urban landscapes. And so I took it a couple of steps further. I started recording, and I put one up on the campus at Fordham, and one of my students, a master's student, her apartment over in Arthur Avenue, the Little Italy of the Bronx, mm-hmm. and another one in the Botanical Garden, and another one in the zoo. And wondering what, if there would be differences. And I found that where it was noisy and light, mm-hmm. far more calls I recorded. Mm-hmm. But with recordings, that doesn't tell you much, mm-hmm. because you don't know, are there more calls because there are more birds? Or is it the same, the same number of birds they're calling more? Is it fewer birds and they're calling a lot more? Mm-hmm. I mean, you don't know. And so what I spent a lot of time on, I finally decided to start using radar, small-scale radar that can actually track individual birds. It's a variation of the kind of radar you would see on small boats. They have mm-hmm. these rotating arms. Well, the equipment that I use has a vertical one and a horizontal one, and it can track individual birds within a mile or so up and out. And so you're able to look and see how many birds are moving at a time, what direction, what height. And what I found through those studies is that, in fact, because we know that light draws birds. So the 9/11 memorial, you know, that's down in the south of Manhattan that happens every year, it's an art installation. It's two towers of light with 44 gigantic lights going straight up, going miles into the air, and it's visible for many miles. But birds, if they're migrating, are attracted. We don't know why, but birds are attracted to light. We've known this since lighthouses came into existence. In the night, when birds are migrating, they will fly to light. And then once they get to the light, they're reluctant to leave. And so they may fly around until they drop of exhaustion or until they hit something or each other. And so massive bird mortality would happen at these lighthouses and these skyscrapers. And the memorial for the 9/11 is monitored by a number of organizations, including New York City Audubon. In some years, the migration isn't happening at that moment. Maybe the winds are the wrong direction or whatever, and it's not a problem. Other years, massive numbers of birds. You know, in the fall, birds are wanting to fly south, and they're not in as a big hurry in the spring. In the spring, everybody's racing madly because whoever gets to the property first wins, usually. Because possession is 9/10 of the law for birds, too. So you want to be there first. So the biggest and the best, fly sooner, get there, advertise, you know, get the girl, raise the kids. But going back, yeah, I got to get there. And so fall migration is much longer. So if the conditions aren't good, like, you know, who wants to fly in a headwind? All right. Or if it's misty, or, you know, nobody. So they'll, you know, they can wait longer. In the spring, birds are riskier, but so you might have 2 weeks where nobody has flown because it's not really very good conditions. And then all of a sudden you have ideal conditions, and if that coincides with the 9/11 memorial, you may have a massive migration occurring. Mm-hmm. And all those birds are being pulled to the light, and so there'll be thousands, tens of thousands of birds flying into those lights.
Oh, gosh.
And so what happens then is, you know, the Municipal Art League, that this is their art, because this is an art piece, this memorial, they turn it off.
They turn it off.
For 30 minutes. And then one by one, they turn all those 88 spotlights back on. And then when there's a protocol for when a certain number of birds are again circling the lights, they turn them off again. Some years, they never have to be turned off. Mm. Other years, they may have to be turned off five times or more during the night. But I began using radar to track those birds, small-scale radar. Now, the weather radar, they're able to dig into that deeply enough. They can't track individual birds as well, but they can actually get a sense of the volume of birds, you know, that are migrating. Mm-hmm. And so combining those, we can begin to see with the acoustic recordings what species. So during my little I've done studies in several cities, and so I began to learn quite a bit about birds moving at night. So there was an art installation going up in Philadelphia, and it was to be a number of 24 different lights that were movable. And you could download an app to your phone and speak a 30-second message into it. And the timbre, the volume, the pattern of your voice would trigger the lights to move in pattern that were connected to the pattern of your thing. So people would propose marriage or read a poem or, and then, you know, the city had, they actually darkened all the street lights. They closed off and, you know, had couches and people could watch, you know, and experience this light show. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, it was slated to go up during migration. And so because of what we know about lights and 9/11 memorial here in New York City, they asked me if I could work with them to see if it was going to be a problem and maybe try to mitigate it. So I talked with the artist who was incredibly, Lorenzo Hammer, was incredibly amenable. So he dimmed the lights. He made sure the lights didn't lead into any buildings since birds follow light. And they turned it off earlier in the night. And we had a team of volunteers with binoculars watching to see if birds were building up in the lights. And they also turned them off briefly between each message. And so if you turn off lights, birds go back to what they should be doing. And so we didn't see evidence that the birds were affected. So it was this sort of wonderful way to try to monitor something that could have had a negative impact. We found none.
The partnership, yeah.
I hope you enjoyed the episode. I apologize for the longer delay between the last episode and this one. Life intervened in the form of a puppy, a broken pair of glasses, and a few other things. But 2020 feels officially underway now, and we have some exciting episodes coming up. I'm working on the Apocalypse series, interviewing a scientist about GMOs. I'll talk to Rabbi Rothstein about the Garden of Eden, and of course, my infamous B-word episode will be coming up too.
Often speak at high school science fairs, and one reason I think I'm invited so often is I chastise parents, and I said, you need to lighten up on your children, because it's not all over
if
they don't achieve what your dream is for them by their junior year of high school. I started law school at 29. I started my PhD at 39, and I do something I love, and can't imagine doing anything else.